Hello, friend. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast, and I hope you hear something truly, I mean this from the bottom of my heart, something that edifies, equips, enlightens, encourages, and then gently but firmly gets you out there into the marketplace of ideas. I so appreciate your taking the time to listen. But before you start the broadcast, let me just take a moment and explain that this month's truth tool is called SEEK, S-E-E-K, written by my friend David Robertson, my favorite Scottish apologist who is currently serving the Lord in Australia. He comes and visits with us once a month. And he wrote a book called Ask, and now he's written a follow-up book called Seek, Real Word Answers to Real World Questions. And so he literally goes through a whole series of questions like, is there ever a good lie? Or does the Bible have mistakes? Or what does the Bible say about climate change? Or what's the difference between capitalism and communism? And the list goes on and on and on. So it is a fabulous reference book that I know you're going to want to put in your legacy library. So if you'd like a copy of Seek, and we are listener-supported radio, I'd love to send one to you when you give a gift of any amount to support In the Market with Janet Parshall. Simply call 877-JANET-58, that's 877-JANET-58, and offer a gift of any amount. We'll send you a copy of David's book, Seek. Or if you'd rather do it online, go to inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Scroll to the bottom of the page. There's the cover. It has a brain on the cover, so you can't miss it. Click on the cover of the book, make your gift right through the website, and we'll send you a copy of Seek by David Robertson. Great tool to have, one of those important little volumes in your ready reference library, and I know you're going to be blessed. By the way, when you're on the website, you might want to consider being a Parshall partner. Those are people who give every single month at a level of their own choosing. They always get whatever the truth tool is that particular month. And in addition to that, they get a newsletter that contains an audio piece from me as well. So Parshall partner or just this month's truth tool, either way, it helps us financially to keep moving forward. 877-JANET-58, 877-JANET-58, or online at inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Now, please, enjoy the broadcast. Hi, friends. Welcome to In the Market with Janet Parshall. It's Heart to Heart Friday, where Craig and I share some of the stories making headlines this week, and then we'll offer our insight and analysis. If you'd like to join in the conversation on what we're talking about, please call 877-548-3675. That's 877-548-3675. Now let's take a quick look back at some of the other topics we discussed this week.
The Israelis will make them sweat it out. If I'm guessing, it won't be tonight. It might be in a week or so, or who knows, a couple of weeks. That's my guess. I may be wrong on that one, but I think you have to do it. You have to. And I remember back in the days of Jimmy Carter, the prime minister from Israel was summoned by Jimmy Carter to come and sit down and visit with him. And apparently the meeting did not go well. Carter just yelled at him for quite a bit of the meeting. The prime minister sat there, didn't say a word. Carter went on and on and on. And finally he looked at him and said, "Are we finished here?" And the prime minister of Israel walked out the door. That's an Israeli for you. So they're going to listen to the advice. They're going to hear it from America, but they're not going to do something that puts their people in harm's way. They're just not going to.
It depends on who you ask in Iran about this event, the attack of Iran on Israel and the counterattack. You get different answers. Like yesterday, you saw the Revolutionary Guards celebrating on the street. Some people have seen that those clips and they think, oh, these are Iranian people. No, they are not Iranian.
There's a whole range of negative outcomes as a result of the fact that we have lost family stability and particularly the loss of father figures within families. And, you know, you can point to these things, but to some degree, in order for politicians to be receptive to that, they have to have, first of all, an open mind, but also some sort of broadly Christian value system or Christian worldview. And I think what we've seen in the last 20 years or so is that increasingly our politicians don't have a broadly Christian worldview, certainly in Europe.
It's not to say we don't care about the climate. I don't go out and pollute my, you know, my own garden or, you know, and on wider issues, we do need to think about things like pollution and so on. But right now, our young people especially are being terrified by a dystopian apocalyptic religion, which says that, I mean, you probably noticed this, but about 5 years ago, Greta Thunberg had tweeted, if we don't stop burning fossil fuels within 5 years, we're all doomed. We're all going to die. Mm-hmm. Well, that was 2017 and we're past that now. She's deleted that tweet. But nonetheless, our children are being indoctrinated into fear, and I would rather them have hope.
We have to face this holy God whose name is we've used as a cuss word. We've lived a life of rebellion. You know, if God didn't give us the ability to blink, our eyes would have dried up. If he didn't give us epiglottis, we would have drowned or choked to death on our first meal. He gave us liver, heart, lungs, kidneys. He breathed life into us. Everything we have came from God, and we're ungrateful, unthankful rebels. And yet he's willing to forgive us and change us and give us a heart that thirsts after him. And that's the miracle of conversion. And that's the miracle that proved the reality of God to me. He took my wicked heart and made me love the God I didn't give 2 seconds serious thought to before I came to Christ.
It's Heart to Heart Friday. Here are some of the other stories making headlines this week.
More than 100 protesters were arrested for trespassing at Columbia University on Thursday while taking part in an ongoing pro-Palestinian demonstration.
Oil prices fell on Monday. Markets dialed back risk premiums following Iran's weekend attack on Israel. One analyst told Reuters that the limited scale of the assault raised hopes that it wouldn't spark major escalation.
Extreme weather doesn't begin to capture what's happening in Dubai. This week, the largest city in the United Arab Emirates got about 2 years worth of rain in one day.
It's Heart to Heart Friday on In the Market with Janet Parshall. Craig and I have lots to share, and we'll put the first story on the table when we return. To join the conversation on the topics we're discussing, call 877-548-3675. That's 877-548-3675. The Bible has the answers to questions being asked by the world, questions about abortion and heaven and even climate change. That's why I've chosen Seek as this month's truth tool. Discover how the Bible offers real word answers to real world questions. Ask for your copy of Seek when you give a gift of any amount to In the Market. Call 877-JANET-58, that's 877-JANET-58, or go to inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Happy Friday to you, friends. Welcome to In the Market with Janet Parshall. Craig Parshall is with me. This is that time of the week when we take a look at some of the stories making headlines and look at them from a markedly different perspective through the lens of Scripture. And so we are seeing an historic rise in anti-Semitism, which is basically hating the Jewish people. And that's something that's been a part of Jewish history practically since the Old Testament. If it isn't Pharaoh going after the Jews, if it wasn't Herod going after the Jews, if it wasn't the Spanish Inquisition, if it wasn't Adolf Hitler, there's constantly been this movement against the Jews. And you and I know something about this, because at its core, and this is where the people who don't know Jesus as their personal Savior and do not spend time in his word, they fail to recognize that at its core, this is a spiritual issue, that there is animus against the Jewish people, because salvation comes by way, finish the Bible verse, right? By way of the Jews. Jesus, a Jewish Messiah. We are grafted on as Gentiles to that Jewish root. So there is a very special relationship we have with the nation of Israel and a very special relationship we have with the Jewish people. So I will say it again. You can disagree if you want to, but you have to realize if you just simply look at proportionality, October 7th was the equivalent of 9/11 for Israel. You can dispute the numbers, but I'm talking about population comparison. And there are still over 133 hostages that have not been returned, and Hamas has not been rooted out. In fact, if anything, we begin to see, especially with what Iran did last weekend, that this is 1,000% a proxy war with Iran, who calls for, without hesitation, the destruction of Israel, referring to that nation as the little Satan, and we, the United States, have the privilege of being called by the Ayatollahs the big Satan. We've discovered Chinese weapons in Hamas. We know that Hezbollah is the extension of Iran and its Iranian guards. We know that in Syria, we've got all kinds of inclusions of the activities by Iran as well. So it's just It's the desire of Iran to throw a match on a tinderbox and to have this whole thing go up in flames. In the meantime, there's wanton ignorance in this country about the history of Israel. There's something about going and traveling there that belies the lies of the BBC and the New York Times, that you see life lived out in front of you and you go, well, I was led to believe things were a whole lot different. Well, what's happening now, and Craig and I have talked about this, I don't think this is happening organically. I do believe that there are bad actors behind the scenes who are paying some of these college students or paying some of these protesters or fomenting this kind of activity through absolute lies. And they are not pro-Palestine. They are anti-Israel. So I wanted you to go to Columbia University. That's the sound that you just heard. That's some chanting that was going on there. Illumine tuo vedibimus lumen. That happens to be the motto of Columbia University. And that gets translated in thy light shall we see light. And it comes from Psalms 36:9. That is, brace yourself, the motto of Columbia University. And that university started back in 1754. And if you want to know a little something about the school, by the way, Columbia University has an admissions committee that reviews tens of thousands of applicants each year and admits only 3.85% of them. This is a school that is deemed to be raising leaders. But what they've been raising are troublemakers the last couple of days, because chaos has erupted on that college campus. And we've got a president at that university that's being grilled because of the anti-Semitism on campus. And I'll play some of her audio later for her being grilled on Capitol Hill. But New York police now have arrested at least 108 people yesterday with this anti-Israel activity that's been taking place. They're back on campus today. The police are there again. Let me have you hear a summation. This comes from ABC News of what's happened in the last 24 hours.
One after the other, pro-Palestine demonstrators were led to NYPD buses in zip ties. A growing crowd chanted in support of their cause just outside Columbia University. Inside, the demonstrators had been occupying the campus's south lawn with tents since early Wednesday morning. It all came to a head when Columbia's president today authorized police to clear the encampment.
She's suppressing the First Amendment right to stand up for what is right. And regardless of whether or not it violates a school protocol, they are standing up for what is right for the people of humanity. We are one people. We are all humans.
Demonstrators converged on both sides of the campus with a growing number of police in riot gear at the ready. Students from across the city rallying around Columbia students who vowed to occupy the lawn until the university divests from Israel-related businesses.
I'm in support of the Columbia students because they're calling for divestment. And obviously, as community students, we agree with that. Our own institution is complicit in that as well.
Dr. Manouche Shafiq has been testifying on Capitol Hill about Columbia's handling of anti-Semitism during the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. As tensions mount on campus, some students simply just having a difficult time getting around.
I can't even get into my dorm right now because they have all of 114th blocked off between Amsterdam and Broadway. So I just it's impossible to move around.
Columbia's president says the following about her decision to let police move in. I took this extraordinary step because these are extraordinary circumstances. The individuals who established the encampment violated a long list of rules and policies.
Unfortunately, what's happening as they're taken off with their plastic handcuffs is they're getting hit with trespassing charges, which is a summons. You don't even get fingerprinted. You don't get your picture taken. And then they come right back and they do it again. So the people showing up today, despite the presence of the police, the numbers are greater today. And they're all, the protesters have been interviewed because obviously reporters want to get a story on this. Every person where a mic was put in their face, they were calling this to be something about their First Amendment. We're going to unpack that, because is that really what this is all about? But if you don't say that you've disrupted somebody else's opportunity to get an education when you're violating the rules of deportment of a university, you're really going to give yourself the bigger headache, because what you're doing is you're teaching students that it's okay. This is what we're seeing all across the country, by the way, not just at Columbia University. You can do something wrong, illegal, inappropriate, and you can get away with it. And given the basic sin nature of man, yep, that is my perspective. And the Bible affirms that, by the way, the human heart in a very despicable place. then what you're doing is you're encouraging even more inappropriate behavior. So, Craig, talk to me about this, because these protests, by the way, while they're at the Columbia University and some of the students were saying, oh, we're so glad because we really shut down the school. We're talking about blocking roads to O'Hare, the Bay Bridge in San Francisco, traffic in New York, Chicago, O'Hare. They couldn't get to the airport. So this is growing and growing and growing. And what's happening is now political pressure is being brought to bear. So Israel, by the way, did in fact respond. They hit a military base, exactly what Tom Doyle predicted earlier this week in my conversation with him. Pinpoint precision right into a military base. And Israel hasn't talked much about it because the operative word in Jerusalem today is de-escalation. I knew that they would have to respond. They did. They did it with precision. They are also sending a message to Iran that we have the capability to respond. Your missiles can hit us and our missiles can hit you. So let that be fair warning. But the White House hasn't said a word for 3 days, hasn't said one single word, partly because, A, the directive from the White House to Benjamin Netanyahu was, hey, it was a win. Just let it sit. And again, as we heard in that opening montage this hour with Tom Doyle, they'll take advisement from any country in the world, but in the end, Israel will do what is necessary to defend herself. So this is not a problem I see mitigating anytime soon. Now you add a heavy layer of political pressure, and I think we've got a growing problem on our hands, to say nothing of the fact that now will Iran respond? They haven't said anything, by the way, with Israel hitting them. So one hopes that basically, they've sent a message to each other, and now it will, in fact, de-escalate. Your thoughts?
Yeah, this is, look, it's a dicey issue, but the bottom line is this. Freedom of speech in terms of protest has very clear and traditional and common sense logical limits. And here are the limits. You can't jump up in the middle of a theater just because you want to disturb people and say, oh, there's a fire, and force people to trample each other getting out. You can't give a false announcement that would cause harm. You can't incite violence. You cannot make what the Supreme Court calls true threats, meaning not just a joke, but infer that you mean physical violent harm to another person. So there are limits to free speech, and one of them is interfering with the administration of a college, prohibiting people from getting to class, stopping traffic. Those are limits on free speech. They have been since really the founding of this nation. It shouldn't be any big news breaking headline that, in fact, people who do this are probably going to be cited for disturbing, for public disturbance, or for civil for some form of public display, illegal assembly, and so forth, some misdemeanor offense. So that shouldn't be, but there's a bigger issue, and that is, why is there such ambivalence about controlling and defining those limits of free speech and protest?
Fascinating question. We're going to talk more about that on the other side. This is In the Market with Janet Parshall. That's Craig Parshall. More topics coming your way right after this.
An unsanctioned pro-Palestinian tent city erected on the campus of Columbia University as the university's president faces tough questioning on Capitol Hill.
The students don't seem to be afraid of your letters.
Chairwoman, I assure you, the students are not getting letters. As has previously been said, we have already suspended 15 students.
President Manushi Shafiq grilled by the House Education Committee for 5 hours over allegations that Columbia doesn't protect Jewish students from anti-Semitism, which even Columbia professors agree is out of control. Professor David Schizer heads Columbia's anti-Semitism task force, created after the October 7th attacks in Israel, which the NYPD confirms brought a spike in anti-Semitic incidents on campus.
Anti-Semitism has no place on our campus, and I am personally committed to doing everything I can to confront it directly.
Not so, said the committee, who blasted what they called Columbia's lack of accountability, focusing on Columbia professor Joseph Massad, who praised the October 7th terrorist attack, calling it, quote, awesome, and is still an active faculty member.
What truly speaks volumes is the moral compass of Columbia, that this rabid anti-Semite is still on your payroll today.
I am appalled by what he said.
Any consequences?
He has been spoken to. And I think you could...
So support of terrorism is acceptable if you're a Columbia professor.
Dr. Shafiq says Columbia is trying to balance allowing free speech while prohibiting hate speech and agrees more needs to be done to protect students. Students we spoke with at Columbia were divided.
I feel angry that the ideals of students in terms of like a socially progressive agenda are not being listened to.
There's an immense amount of hostility towards Jews and pro-Israel students. I get looks. I'm genuinely scared in the classroom of repercussions if I, like from the professor, if I give a pro-Israel, you know, answer.
President Shafiq says the university has dismissed several professors who have made anti-Semitic remarks. They have also designated certain areas for protests and increased channels for reporting discriminatory behavior. In the newsroom, Jessica Moore, CBS 2 News.
No, not enough. And by the way, this tells full circle back to this idea of free speech again. You know, there were students yesterday and today that are literally chanting, "I am Hamas." Now, Hamas, even by this government, is deemed to be a terrorist organization. So this is going to get interesting, Craig. Where do you draw the line between free speech and an incitement toward hatred? And by the way, this is all about hating the Jewish people. So again, how does this intersect with free speech when you've got over 100 people arrested because they're hating the Jewish people? And again, the chants of "from the river to the sea," which is nothing but a blatant call for genocide. It is language right out of the PLO charter. All of the accords that have taken place, the Y Plantation Accord, the Oslo Accord, the list goes on and on and on. If you know your Jewish history, all of them call for the removal of the language from the PLO charter, of the language "from the river to the sea," because what that means is drive the Jews into the Mediterranean and kill them all. That is the working definition of genocide. So these are pro-genocide, hateful remarks. We jump up and down in this country about hate crimes and hate speech, and when it's all over the campus of Columbia University, it's a blind eye and a deaf ear.
Well, I think it's more than that. It's an implied threat. If you say, "I am Hamas," all of us here as protesters, they seem to be implying, strongly suggesting, we're all Hamas, which means, well, Hamas went in and slaughtered families and murdered innocent people. And so, therefore, we not only support them, you might expect us to cause physical harm to you. Now, if you're a Jewish or even a pro-Israel a Gentile going to Columbia University, does that message or does that message not give you some concern about your own safety, whether you're going to be attacked? Because if you identify with a terrorist organization, which they are, Hamas has been declared by a number of countries that have some semblance of a democracy, UK, United States, Australia, and others, as a terrorist organization that happens to be in control of Gaza, unfortunately, then really what you're saying is you can expect terrorist type activity from us against you if you support Israel or if we find out you're a Jew. Now, that has nothing to do with free speech. The Supreme Court's made it clear. Columbia University touts some kind of understanding of freedom of speech. And so I think that the actions they took, unfortunately, were too slow. But to call police in to break up these kinds of protests that, number one, create a public disturbance, which is a violation of criminal law as a misdemeanor. But number two, that represent implied threats against the Jewish community of students there on the campus. There's no question that they have the right to bring in police enforcement and to break that up and stop those kind of threats.
Wow. So is part of the problem here because there isn't a strong enough police presence to be able to say, you know, you're welcome to do free speech. And, you know, you heard the president talk about the fact that certain areas are going to be designated where people can gather and do that. And that's great. I mean, college is about the idea of exchanging ideas, of sifting and weighing all kinds of things. And so you begin to concretize your own particular worldview. But when you draw the line, this is where I just have no patience whatsoever in all this conversation among progressives about hate crimes, because is it not a hate crime to say drive them from the river to the sea? Is it not a hate crime to call yourself a terrorist? I mean, if instead of Hamas it said, "I am ISIS" or "I am Al-Qaeda," what kind of a
right
response would you
in
get?
In other words, Christians often, when they cite a biblical text that makes culture uncomfortable, we're called hateful. Well, I can think of nothing more hateful than to say we are Hamas, basically saying, and if you're a Jew, you know what Hamas does to Jews. That's the implication of that. That is the quintessential kind of hate speech that no university, that particularly one that costs you about $85,000 a year to attend, should tolerate. And of course, the parents who send their children shouldn't tolerate it either.
We're going to take a break and be right back. This is In the Market with Janet Parshall. Craig Parshall is with me. On the other side, we'll take up another topic that also ties into the concept of truth and free speech. Back after this. We can all safely say that society seems to be decaying before our eyes. On In the Market, we're tackling the issues head-on from a biblical perspective so you'll know how to influence and occupy, as Scripture says. Become a Parshall partner today and support In the Market. As a benefit, you'll receive exclusive resources every week prepared just for you. Call 877-JANET-58 or go online to inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. So let's continue our conversation about free speech, because this is hugely important, not just because there's some idealistic approach to the First Amendment, the first of 10 amendments that make up our Bill of Rights, but because for us as Christians, it gives us the freedom and the liberty to do something that so many of our brothers and sisters globally can't do, and that is to fully proclaim the whole counsel of God. We're looking at hate crimes legislation for pastors in Scotland now, where they could go to jail for 7 years if they preach the whole counsel of God. We look at the same thing that's going on in Canada. We look in California, where if a person doesn't use someone's preferred pronouns, quote unquote, whatever that means, and you're a parent and you won't acquiesce and affirm that, you could be deemed as somebody who has practiced a form of child abuse. So all of these free speech issues have very important aspects to them. But for us in particular, it gives us the liberty to say Jesus is Lord. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, the Bible says you will be saved. I can make that declaration, and I don't have to give equal time to Zoroastrianism, Scientology, Islam, Buddhism, any other religion. You can change the channel if you want to. But I can say that without fear of repercussion or government imprisonment or control over the content of my speech. Now, last Friday, we talked to you about Yuri Berliner. Yuri Berliner was a longtime NPR editor. He was an award-winning editor, and after 25 years, he had had it. He had done a retrospective of the newsroom. There were absolutely only members of one political party, and it wasn't the Republicans. He felt that the reporting was biased. He felt that they were withholding objective facts and news stories so that you could spin the story in a particular way. And he was someone who said no. In fact, I applaud him. While he and I probably don't share the same worldview, he's interested in better journalism, and so am I. And for him to be able to say, you didn't have well-rounded stories, you were espousing a particular progressive liberal worldview, and if it didn't fit the narrative, it was exorcised out of the story. Now, we know that to be true. If you watch any news outlet, it's why more and more people are getting their news from different sources other than the alphabet soups, and why their viewership numbers are falling, because the palpable bias is there. And rather than a disclaimer that goes across the bottom of the screen saying this is not objective reporting, it is subjective opinionating, if there's such a word, people have now found that out for themselves. It started out with a bumper sticker that said, I don't believe the liberal media. Now we know the media is liberal. And so does Yuri Berliner. So at the beginning of our conversation last week when we shared this with you, we said that he had put this article in a platform that he has called Free Press, and he explained why he's leaving. In fact, he said, and I quote, I'm resigning from NPR, a great American institution where I've worked for 25 years. I don't support calls to defund NPR. I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and to do important journalism, but I cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO, more on her in a minute, whose divisive views confirm the very problems at NPR I cited in my Free Press essay. And he was referring to Catherine Marr, and we're going to get to her in a minute. And she took over last month as the president and CEO. And, you know, it's funny. In a world with social platforms, everything you say can and will be used against you. And so she's left a long trail of her very bizarre far leftist worldviews, which does nothing but underscore Yuri Berliner's opinion. Well, what happened at the beginning of this week is that he resigned. He has now officially left NPR. And again, that took some chutzpah. I'll use a Yiddish word, but that took a lot of guts to be able to say no. And so he said, I am resigning from NPR. This was his letter to NPR CEO, Catherine Marr. I am resigning from NPR, a great American institution where I've worked for 25 years. I don't support calls to defund NPR. I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and to do important journalism. But I cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problems at NPR I cite in my free press essay. Enter the social platforms that are out there. And in fact, this Catherine Meyer is, in fact, extremely left-leaning. She's given some TED Talks where she shared some bizarre ideas. And her whole perspective about truth and the Constitution and free speech comes into play now, given the position she has as the new CEO of NPR. Listen to what she says.
The hard things, the places where we are prone to disagreement, say politics and religion. Well, as it turns out, not only does Wikipedia's model work there, it actually works really well. Because in our normal lives, these contentious conversations tend to erupt over disagreement about what the truth actually is. But the people who write these articles, they're not focused on the truth. They're focused on something else, which is the best of what we can know right now. And after 7 years of working with these brilliant folks, I've come to believe that they are onto something, that perhaps for our most tricky disagreements, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done. Now, that is not to say that the truth doesn't exist, nor is it to say that the truth isn't important. Clearly, the search for the truth has led us to do great things, to learn great things. But I think if I were to really ask you to think about this, one of the things that we could all acknowledge is that part of the reason we have such glorious chronicles to the human experience and all forms of culture is because we acknowledge there are many different truths. And so in the spirit of that, I'm certain that the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you. But this may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often, for many people, what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world. So we all have different truths. They're based on things like where we come from, how we were raised, and how other people perceive us.
Wow. That's a whole semester of philosophy class right there. There are many different truths. And actually, the question shouldn't be what the truth actually is, but rather what we know, subjectivity in its very definition. So this woman, by the way, was a former co-founder of Wikipedia, which is a page where you can kind of make it up as you go along. So it really goes to her whole worldview. But the idea then about really different truths out there, so then it raises the question to NPR, which gets some funding from taxpayers all across the country. Well, whose truth are you broadcasting then? I know something that you don't know, and I don't hear it being broadcast on NPR with any regularity whatsoever. But the statement is vacuous on itself. If you have one truth and the person sitting next to you, to use her verbiage, has another truth, logic says you cancel each other's truth out. The wonderful thing about objective truth is it is knowable, number one. Number two, it applies to all people and all times and all places. And you don't make it up, and it isn't predicated on your experience. It's predicated on truth, objective, knowable, transcendent truth. Your thoughts?
I find it shocking that the CEO of NPR, National Public Radio, would be so transparent. Now, on the other hand, I'm very glad that she did, because I've followed NPR, I've had meetings with NPR, and I've been on a testimonial panel with executives from NPR in front of the Federal Communications Commission. And they, I'm going to tell you something, their programming production value is superb. It ought to be, because they're taxpayer supported. But they do an excellent job in terms of the production value. However, the way in which they editorialize their decisions has always been skewed, in my opinion, and I followed them very closely, as you have. Now, here's the deal. Let's talk about truth. Her statement was stunning, that, of course, truth is important. But then she makes two statements that delegitimize what she just said about, well, you know, truth is important. No, it really isn't. Because she said, number one, that truth, if you have too much reverence for it, is getting in the way mm-hmm. of common ground with people.
Right.
We just need to get along with each other, and particularly ideas about religion and politics. Well, politics, let's take politics and break it down. Our founders believed that you needed an informed electorate. That's you and I and everybody listening to your radio program, to be informed of the issues and the actual state of affairs of the nation, so that when we go into a voting booth or we handwrite or punch a card into a voting machine, that prior to that point, we've really been informed adequately about who we're voting for, what they really believe, and what issues are important. NPR has been choosing, as Yuri now makes very clear, and a lot of us have seen over the years, they've chosen, from an editorial standpoint, to avoid issues that will help one political party that they don't like. So they will bury those stories, or at least bury the lead on those stories, because they're afraid that the wrong people will get elected. That's not the role of the press. As a matter of fact, our founder said just the opposite. The freedom of the press in the First Amendment, the background of it was so that we could hold government officials to account regardless of what their party position is or their worldview, that it had to be a free press so that there's a diversity of opinions and journalism so that we can expose the wrong and support the good public policy that helps the nation to grow. So truth in that way is important. But more important for the Christian, truth is paramount because Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Paul said, speak the truth in love. In love, yes, but also speak the truth. Truth is important to God. It's important to Christians. Apparently, it isn't important to NPR.
I think there's a lot more to this conversation as well. And this is one of those that makes us think a little bit deeper about why espousing truth is important and whether or not you practice situational ethics, ardent humanism, your truth, find your truth, I'll find my truth, and in the end, we'll all just get along and live in abject moral chaos and confusion. I'm not interested in that world. I hope you're not either. Back after this. So Craig and I are sharing some thoughts about Yuri Berliner, this award-winning journalist at NPR for 25 years, who finally lifted the shades, opened the front door, let the sunshine in to what a lot of people were suspicious of and had a strong sense was happening, where really and truly it wasn't about objective journalism. It wasn't better journalism. It was about advocacy. And that's exactly the shift that we've seen in the newsroom in general right now, that the distinction between offering an opinion and being objective in just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. And if you know what TV show that came from, you're in the same age bracket I am. But the reality is this new CEO, Catherine Meyer, and her statements that have now been come out and been discovered and put on social platforms all across the world, is that this is exactly why Yuri Berliner left. That, in fact, she is about advocacy and comes up with this crazy idea that it's about all of us having different worldviews. In fact, makes this statement where she says, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction, really, because the book of Proverbs doesn't say that. It tells us to get wisdom, by the way, which is truth. But she says, our reverence for truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding good common ground and getting things done. More on that in a moment. So let me tell you what C.S. Lewis had to say about this. He said, if you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth, only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin, and in the end, despair. Catherine Meyer is peddling soft soap. So this idea of let's all just have common ground really falls again under its own weight. When Jesus talks about his message, Craig, he says several things about it, not the least of which is he refers to it as a sore. And the sword will divide people, those who said yes to what is a knowable, objective, transcended, immutable truth, and those who said yes. It divides. The truth can pull people together if people collectively all subscribe to the same transcendent truth that is objective and knowable and applicable. But in fact, it's going to divide people who don't want to subscribe to that truth and find their own personal self-generated truth to be transcendent over what is objective truth. So you can't have it both ways. You know, there's a level ground at the cross. We stand together under the shibboleth, that old-fashioned word in the King James, the banner is what it means, of the cross. But it's for common good and common ground for common good and common ground's sake is nothing but pablum. I go back to exactly what C.S. Lewis said. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth, only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin, and in the end, despair. Hers in the end, in the final analysis, her message is full of despair.
You know, I mentioned a couple of problems just on the pragmatic level with NPR and the CEO's worldview and her statements. Number one, it's taxpayers funded. That means you and I are actually supporting this journalistic endeavor, which is failing at journalism. Number two, it's betraying the vision of journalism that the founders specifically wanted to protect in the First Amendment so that we would have a diversity of opinion discussing all facts, all pertinent and relevant issues so the American people could be not only informed with regard to being an electorate and running the government, but also that freedom of belief, freedom of faith based on belief, based on the facts as you see them, is so sacred that it needed to be protected from government overreach. But there's another reason. NPR is a market dominant force in radio. They have over 1,000 radio stations coast to coast. They are a monolithic force for information, but only certain information, which means a lot of folks aren't going to get the whole story, the whole truth for the whole population. They're going to get the truth as they see it. But let me go to another point. And that is, she said, your truth may not be my truth. In other words, this is the situational ethic. In fact, I was a undergraduate in college when I heard a speech by a guy by the name of Joseph Fletcher, the inventor, mm-hmm. not really the inventor, but the most prominent source for the idea of situational ethics. And what he was saying is all things are relevant. All things are relative. And therefore, there is no absolute standard that you can apply to right and wrong and to ultimate issues of life. Is there heaven or is the grave the end of all human life? Those kinds of worldviews apparently are rampant in NPR, and people should know that if they decide to listen in. Now, I'm not saying don't listen to certain radio stations. As a matter of fact, when the Apostle Paul, as we've often said on this show, arrived at Athens, the seat of philosophical thought at the time, he went up to the epicenter of philosophical thought and got an audience with these so-called great minds of Athens at the time and shared about the truth of Jesus Christ. He got some of his message out, but when he talked about the resurrection of Jesus, they shut him down. So this has been an issue that is longstanding since civilization, since the beginning of the world. If you speak the truth, you're going to have some enemies. But let's understand that truth is not something that you fashion on a personal level. Truth is something that's objective and absolute. And if you don't take God's definition of truth, then the only other source of truth is going to be human speculation and imagining, which is a dead end, ultimately. Mm.
So she's got a trail of 29,000 tweets. And again, your language follows you. So if you look at some of her buzzwords, she uses phrases like structural privilege, epistemic emergency, transit justice, non-binary people, late stage capitalism, the white mobility privilege. She compares driving cars with smoking cigarettes. She's very concerned about toxic masculinity. So those are her words. That is her worldview. And now she says, and impliedly, I guess you'd have to say those are her truths. Well, those wouldn't be the truths that I would subscribe to. So in the final analysis, what is right? You can't believe that driving cars is the moral equivalent of smoking cigarettes. Or you can believe that, but there's no neutral position on that. Is driving a car the moral equivalent of smoking a cigarette? And if it is, who says so? What metric do you use? Is it right to steal your neighbor's car? Is it right to take the life of another human being through murder? So these are transcendent questions for which there are answers. And that's the paradox out of all of this. Lofty, flirted TED Talks fill the air with interesting words, and in the end, they are vacuous. And that's why the First Amendment is important. You and I show up in the marketplace, we exercise that First Amendment right, but we speak truth, always through a grace narrative, but we unashamedly proclaim truth, because in the end, it is truth that sets every one of us free. And that's the most loving message we can deliver. Thanks for joining us, friends. We'll see you next time on In the Market with Janet Parshall.